they argue from a social perspective that there are sort of cultural elements, or by that I mean like civic culture, political cultural elements that it most influence voter turnout. And so these authors, I'll cite them directly here. So we have authors like Almond and Verba, who talk about the civic culture. And so you have some different, you have the three kind of culture, styles of culture that encourage a certain degree of involvement in the political sphere. So the parochial culture is characterized by apolitical citizens who are politically unaware and uninvolved. What they call the subject culture is where citizens may be aware of the state and their policy, but they lack agency. They're just kind of political pawns to be mobilized. And then participant culture is where people are aware of the workings of the system and they have an active role in expressing their interests and, of course, in voting. And what you say, Aaron, I think really highlights that idea that if we're stuck listening to our own echo chambers, or if we don't go out and engage with ideas that are different than our own, what happens is I would see it as like a vicious cycle where the less you engage with other people, the less you want to engage with other people because it's comfortable to sit in your own bubble of similar ideas. And the problem with that is that we no longer have ideas being shared on policies that really matter. And, you know, and policy and on ideas that influence politicians in the way they are running the show. So if people don't go out into the public sphere and talk to each other about policy, they have less idea of what changes could possibly be made and what is currently being done, and then less involvement in the political sphere and, if, for example, in voting. And so I think that's the other really important part of this, is to engage with other people in the political sphere or in the sphere of discussion leads directly, I think, to a better idea of how to engage politically and what ideas you want to see shared and improved. And I'll just summarize that with a little piece from my conclusion here, and then I'll invite you, the two of you, to comment. So I said, this is why individuation is key to counteracting modern political dissatisfaction and disinterest. It is only by understanding one's values, as Kierkegaard would have all individuals strive to do, that one can have a confident and full moral bearing on the world. Then, rather than taking this faith to the absurd, Mill's methodology of discourse allows it to be turned to the political. As these values are put forth and critiqued, one will come forth which holds the best course of action for society to take to progress morally and socially. Finally, when this agreement is reached, an incentive is created to engage in the political sphere in order to elect powers that will truly further those visions, thus encouraging political participation and satisfaction in the mutually discovered end result.
I was going to say, too, one of the interesting things about this is that I feel like I don't think this is a critique or anything. I think that these two things are kind of similar, but that you can take them apart and see them as doing two different things, I think, is interesting. Is you kind of equate Kierkegaard's inward turn to both discovering one's own values and also individuating someone. So I think that there is a necessary component of finding your values that is involved in individuation, but it's really interesting that this has the political consequence of individuating a person, specifically in relation to Kierkegaard's notion of kind of an amorphous, always nothing, but always something else public. That seems to be kind of similar to what Mill is talking about as well, a tyranny of majority that can say whatever it wants and change opinions the next day. I feel like this inward turn towards individuation I don't want to say immunizes a person against getting swept up in these things, in these groups or these echo chambers, but that really does seem to be a consequence of it. If you discern your values, if you individuate yourself, if you become a discrete political kind of unit, you will have an easier time resisting falling into these echo chambers or finding out that you were part of one all the whole time and being able to extract yourself from that. I think that that's the move of individuation that you say is it's important.
Yeah, and you do have a good point there. I mean, again, in the spirit of not being in an echo chamber, I'm totally happy to hear critiques. Don't get me wrong. I'll make that clarification then, because I think you brought up an important point. So audience members might be wondering if I'm throwing about the term individuation incorrectly, and I would say I don't think I am, because just to clarify, if you look up a standard definition of individuation, you're talking about bringing the aspects of the unconscious into the conscious, right? And you're talking about becoming a whole and independent personality that has a grasp on things that are otherwise unconscious, such as values, I think, that many of us might act on without really knowing how to articulate, or that we've never tried to articulate. So that is exactly what I mean. And I think you're right. It's maybe counterintuitive, but I think if we follow that process in the right way, it really can be, as you said, a benefit, like you said, a kind of immunization against falling into those traps of just being one with the herd. And I can see a criticism of people saying that, oh, the last thing we need right now is more atomistic, because, that makes us even more disconnected from each other and what have you. But I think to be polarized and to be belligerent isn't the same thing as being properly individual. I think if you are a strong individual who understands the ideas that you're bringing into the world and your biases and your values and all of that, that makes you more valuable in the discussion. And then you're free to associate yourself with whoever you want and be part of a community. I'm not saying that you should only focus on yourself, but to be a whole complete individual is what's going to make you more valuable in terms of bringing ideas forward into the public sphere to be discussed with others. You compromise with others, you associate with others, and then you demand of your political structure to bring you the changes and to bring the values forward that you have and that you've now convinced maybe a larger group of people to share with you by speaking them and by discussing them. So I think that's the distinction there.
I did want to touch a little bit more on the notion of political discontent, so to speak.
Sure.
Philosophically speaking, and maybe I'll change the term to philosophical discontent, because when we've talked on the show about different thinkers and different perspectives, it becomes very clear that a lot of these ideas conflict with each other and that you can't hold every idea at once. And on the other side of things, it also becomes very clear that if you stay very, very rigidly within one set of philosophical ideas, well, I guess that's kind of the question. Is that a good thing? If you do this type of internal investigation and it leads you to very rigorously holding and defending a very specific set of ideas, can that necessarily be a bad thing, or is that necessarily always a good thing? What's the process there that defines that as, I guess, utilitarianly being practical or useful would be the way that Mill would divide those two things about, like, well, if it's useful to you to hold these individual beliefs vigorously, then do so. If it's not useful, don't. But I do think there's hopefully a better answer there.
Yeah. Before I jump in on that, Brandon, did you want to respond?
Kinda. Yeah. There's like a very, I don't know how together this response is to it, but in a certain way, say I have. Well, I mean, Kierkegaard's kind of inward turn is a discovery of a relationship that you have to existence or to God or something. It essentially is meant to spark a kind of fundamental commitment or desire. And if utilitarianism is about maximizing something, whatever our means are towards our happiness, which I think Mill cites as the end for which utilitarianism is established, I would think that establishing what it is that you want is really important in a utilitarian project. So I think that Kierkegaard could give us, if Kierkegaard does give us a way to do that, I do think that there is there's a possibility for a compatibility between those two. So I guess when you're asking, is this good or bad? Well, I guess that, or is people going into themselves and discovering what it is they want as an individual, is that good or bad? Well, I mean, you would want to know what you want anyway, right? You kind of have to have that end. That's a necessary point. That's a necessary component of establishing the means to the end.
Yeah. No, I think you're touching on a good point there, which is that if you agree that discussion is a good way to come to conclusions as a group that bring that are best for us, that bring us that help us to thrive, right? Morally speaking, let's say. If you think that discussion and that consensus is a good thing, or if not consensus, at least, you know, a constant discussion which brings forward new ideas and ways of thriving, if you think that's a good thing, then you want to come to that discussion prepared to have it. And like Brandon said, to come to a discussion about what we should do, morally speaking, you need to come prepared with ideas of what is moral, right? You need to come prepared with ideas of how do I achieve my greatest happiness and maybe the greatest happiness of people like me, right? And so even if you disagree with the utilitarian idea, which I happen to, even if you disagree that it's only about maximizing a certain good, let's say happiness, that somewhere in that premise in there, you disagree with, and so you disagree with the ethical school of thought, you should still be able to say that you should still have some idea of what is morally good, how do we progress morally. And I think the only way you're going to either find something that changes your mind on that or find new ideas that help you support that thought, or the way you're going to convince other people to think like you, if you're really strong in that belief, is by going into the public sphere. And so I think what you were getting at though, Aaron, is there a danger to being really adamant, to wanting to die on a certain hill? And that's a tough question that I don't know if I have an answer to, because on the one hand, I would say if you've gotten to the point where you are willing to die on a certain philosophical hill, it means that you've thought about it so much and you've thought about other rebuttals and things so much that at the end of that gauntlet, you're still left with this belief, which is pretty valuable. And you being a strong proponent for that could be really useful. On the other hand, you being unwilling to change on that point could be a sign that you're no longer willing to engage with people in that civic discourse. And so there's a line to tread there. And, you know, people talk about, if you're talking about sort of comparative mythology, storytelling, there's this figure of like the tyrant, Holdfast, right? That eventually it's a king who maybe does well by his people for a certain period of time. And then at the end becomes old, becomes adamant in his traditional ideas. And the hero has to come along and either slay this king or just, you know, depose him in some way to bring about change to society. And that's going to happen. I think there are going to be people that end up holding ideas for the rest of their lives that maybe need changing. But I think the fact that they were willing to go through the process of analyzing that idea, analyzing rebuttals, and figuring out that, hey, this is valuable to me and I think to other people for at least a time, I think that's worth the lag that we might get when people hold those ideas too long. So I would say, on the whole, it's it still contributes to progress, and I would say it's still a good thing, even if you risk having some people that, you know, are unwilling to change their minds after a long time.
I think one of the most pertinent academic questions here is how we allow this discussion to influence who the people we talk to are. Like, who is included in the discussion and who is not included in the discussion. When you seek to have an open discourse, who do you invite to that discourse? And again, I guess, as Brandon was saying earlier, it comes down to kind of what your purpose is. After you've done that internal investigation into what your ideas and what your own values are, you'll have a sense of the things that you want to discuss and perhaps how you want to discuss them. And that might determine what type of people you have that discussion with. Is that process the same process we're talking about when we're talking about open public discussion? Because if we, you know, if it's left to an individual to subjectively decide, you know, this person's invited and this person's not invited, aren't those types of biases a barrier to the type of social progress that we're proposing?
So my response to that is that the democratic, you know, Western liberal state gives that arena by virtue of rule of law, right? Freedom of speech. And I think, so as an individual, I think it's important to recognize that you should be speaking to as many people with as many diverse perspectives as possible to really get the best, you know, the most solid ideas for yourself, because rebuttals can come from many different angles, ways you haven't thought about your ideas before. So the more people you're willing to talk to about a certain idea, and the more criticism you're willing to get on it, the stronger that idea will become, either because you realize there's really a hole in it and you change your mind, or you find a way to rebut that and you're even stronger in your initial belief. So first of all, I think it's important to talk to as many people as possible from an individual perspective. From a political and, you know, societal perspective, having that arena for public discourse is vital. And that's where I think these echo chambers get really dangerous, is that people will not only interact with those that agree with them, but they might actively try and shut down, to eliminate ideas that aren't similar to their own. And I think that's the biggest danger, because having the arena to have this public discourse, if you are unwilling as an individual to engage in that, that's your problem. But if there isn't a place for you to be able to find people that disagree with you and have a discussion without being ousted, that's everyone's problem. I would say, in terms of choosing your opponents, a really good piece of advice that I've received is, if someone is not listening, if someone is unwilling to listen to you, don't bother trying to talk to them. This is just a bit of personal advice, but like, if someone is really just doesn't want to hear what you have to say and they're just shouting their own opinion and that's that, it's not worth your time to talk to them. That's not furthering anyone's aims. So on an individual level, I think it's important to try and be open. And if you find people that aren't open, you know, find someone else to talk to. But on the public scale, you have to have an arena in which that discourse can happen for a society to be politically strong, for people not to lose faith in the political system that's in place, and for those ideas to be aired and discussed and then implemented if people think it's important to do so.
Yeah, something. So if the question is, how do we decide who to have these discussions with? I think that I feel like it's kind of obvious, but there's something to be said about the fact that we are kind of always already doing this anyways. So the way that I'm kind of meaning that is, like, let's say I have a political cause that I'm interested in, something like animal rights. I'm already kind of self-selecting, and I'm self-selecting in a very non-controversial way by, I'm not going to go to the, I don't know, a kind of, I'm not going to go to a convention for another political cause, right? I'm going to go to the convention where they discuss animal rights, if that's my cause. So in a certain way, your who you admit into this discussion with will just be bound by the fact of the commitment that you commit yourself to. So that's one thing. And then the second thing I can think about with this is, if that is something that brings you into that arena or that space to have that discussion, I would, I maybe this is a bit, I'm going to say this because I think this is a, it's an important thing. If you go somewhere, like, let's say I go to somewhere for animal rights and I'm having discussions about these, if I'm really truly committed to that, I feel like I would be very open to having discussions with everyone who would also find themselves there and who were equally as committed as I was, because I could tell that if I have a kind of passion for this, or if this is something that really moves me, I feel like I would have a kind of way of discerning who else was really moved by that too, and could come together, we could come together in consort to take advantage, not just of all the arguments. Maybe there are all these incredible arguments for it. We can put it on like a utilitarian basis. But for me, what really would have brought me there is a fundamental commitment that I found in that Kierkegaardian inward turn. And it's something you can't really articulate, but you can kind of tell when someone is really committed to a particular cause. Is that unarticulable intuition politically suspect or dangerous? Maybe. But there really are people who have to have that sort of feeling to be able to go forward and do that. I think this kind of meshes with the advice that you give, Mihai. I would suspect that someone who isn't willing to listen on a particular issue is a person who lacks a fundamental commitment to that issue.
I think that's interesting. I don't know if I agree with you, because I think you're right. There is a kind of solidarity that people foster when they go into the kinds of arenas that are based on the interests that they have. So I go to an animal rights convention because I love animals. Maybe I've never once in my life thought about what's the reason for this, or why am I doing this, or what's the arguments, but I just really like, I know I really like animals. I know I like people that like animals. So here I am. Just because they are unwilling, let's say that someone comes along who doesn't like animals, and let's say this is the kind of person that I'm suggesting you should be, the kind of person that goes into an animal rights convention who doesn't believe in animal rights to talk to people and to see, why do you guys care so much about animal rights? I think that's a valid thing to do, not to disrupt them or to shut down their ideas, but to be like, hey, what am I missing? So let's say that's the kind of person I'm suggesting that the audience try to be, though we've seen that, you know, there are many people that try to monetize this kind of process and are kind of faking doing this. But I mean, really honestly, trying to talk to people that share your interests. So let's say I'm suggesting you be that kind of person. And then the kind of person that I was just talking about is just there because they feel this connection to these other people. They've never really thought about it. They see this person come in and they immediately shut down. They're like, this person is awful. They hate animals. And I think they should get out of here. Just because they can't articulate their position doesn't mean they lack the commitment, but maybe that commitment comes from a place that is irrational or is somehow not supported because they haven't thought to themselves, why am I really doing this? Right. And that's fanaticism. And Mill talks about this. I actually talk about this in my paper because Mill brings this up as well. That's what you risk. This is a really good point to end on, I think, for today. I talk about this idea that, like, if you are going on the path of faith that requires you to abandon all rationality and, you know, and dive into something by feeling, right, by value, by that internal dive, Kierkegaard talks about this. He says, there exists this danger of fanaticism, where, so I'll quote here. So where these authors may unexpectedly agree is that on the basis that individuals should always stand above the collective where judgment of values is concerned. So we've talked about this. You dive into yourself, you find your values, you discuss them. To adapt and to change a structure of values requires rational thought, critical analysis, and clear and equitable discourse between individuals with conflicting opinions. Any system in which individuals fall to blindly supporting the claims of their selected group of association on the belief that a majority opinion or an established tradition constitutes validity will then attempt to force that opinion on others. Regardless of whether an opinion's premises are valid, it may still be an opinion that no longer accurately reflects the needs of the group as it pursues progress. This is what Kierkegaard called the danger of fanaticism. And when applied more broadly than just to religion, which is what Kierkegaard was talking about, it bears striking resemblance to the tyranny of the majority. So that's exactly what we were just talking about here. Fanaticism, where you just blindly follow the majority because of that feeling of solidarity, but you miss the rational critical element, is dangerous. But if you take the dive within and find those things that you connect with and then think to yourself, why is that? What is pushing me to have these opinions or these values? Where is this coming from? And then you're able to articulate that rationally to other people. That's when you're really going to get the kind of discussion, I think, that pushes people forward and pushes society forward. And I think that was a good analogy to tie that idea home, Brendan.
Yeah, thank you for that.
I think that just about does it for my time with you folks today. So I'll end off by saying that you've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show and our episode today about individuation as a potential cure for disinterest or discontent in civic and political society and the philosophical stepping stones that we can use to get there, analyzing Kierkegaard and Mill for this particular work. I really appreciate you guys talking to me today, reading my work and analyzing it, and I'd be happy to bring some of these ideas forward again sometime soon whenever we get the chance on another episode. I'll just remind our audience one more time that you can find the show at tcps.podbean.com, or if you just look up the Canadian Philosophy Show on Podbean, where you can find previous episodes like our existentialist series, which we should be continuing fairly shortly for you here. Thanks a lot for listening. Thank you to my guests, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find archived recordings of the Canadian Philosophy Show on mixcloud.com/thecanadianphilosophyshow and tcps.podbean.com.
The SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance, referred to as DNA, is a student-led network of community members who identify as disabled, autistic, neurodivergent, deaf, mad, and or as having a disability, a chronic illness, long-term condition, or a mental illness. At DNA, we work together to create campus change. We address ableism, and we promote disability justice while opposing oppression in all of its forms. We are the SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance. We are DNA. We provide support for students who are having difficulty with their schooling or accessing the services they need. Email access@sfss.ca or drop by the DNA Resource Center, room 1300 in the sub-building. That was access@sfss.ca, room 1300 in the sub-building.
Does your mother say it? Ow! Ow! I hate it! Thank you.
I'm a dirty old witch. I'm a dirty old witch.